This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Gordon Sondland, ambassador to the European Union, finds himself in a pressure-packed, pivotal role as the star witness of this week's congressional impeachment hearings on Wednesday, targeting President Donald Trump. His testimony comes a day after the Intelligence Committee heard from four witnesses, three of whom directly listened to Trump's July 25th telephone call with Ukraine's president to investigate Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. The AP's Ed Donahue has more.
Vice President Mike Pence's representative on the National Security Council, Jennifer Williams, thought the call involving an investigation of Joe Biden was unusual.
Struck me as political in nature, given that the former vice president is a political opponent of the president.
Career Army officer Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman with the National Security Council called it improper.
Frankly, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was probably an element of shock.
Republicans like Utah's Chris Stewart says Democrats are going too far on the contents of the phone call.
I had to tell you, I think it's nonsense. Look, I was in the military. I could distinguish between a favor and an order.
Vindman is an immigrant who came to the U.S. as a toddler from Ukraine. He faced questions from Republicans about his loyalty. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The United States imposed new sanctions on individuals and networks for providing financial support to the Islamic State terror group. The U.S. Treasury Department on Monday said the new round of sanctions targeting four individuals and five companies operating in Syria, Turkey, Afghanistan, and several other countries for their involvement in supporting the Islamic State financially and logistically. U.S. officials said after the U.S. operation killed the Islamic State leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, last month, the U.S. government has increased its efforts to undermine the terror group's financial capabilities. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo changed a long-standing U.S. policy saying Jewish settlements in the West Bank do not violate international law. Israeli officials warmly welcomed the statement. Palestinians are furious. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made the controversial statement in Washington.
Establishment of Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank is not per se inconsistent with international law. The hard truth is there will never be a judicial resolution to the conflict, and arguments about who is right and wrong as a matter of international law will not bring peace.
A United Nations spokesman said there was no change in its policy toward the settlements, which is that they are illegal according to international law. Overnight, four rockets were fired from Syria at Israel and were shot down by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israeli officials said they believed the rockets were from pro-Iranian groups. It was not clear if there was a direct connection to Pompeo's statement. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Thousands of immigrants who were blocked from seeking asylum in the U.S. get a favorable ruling from a federal judge in California. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
July 16th, the Trump administration changed its asylum policy, announcing that anyone who had traveled through another country before the U.S. border would be denied. Immigrant advocates went to court on behalf of thousands of migrants who obeyed instructions at the border that they should wait in Mexico to apply for U.S. asylum. But then the new ban made them ineligible. A federal judge has sided with them, ruling that anyone who appeared at an official U.S. border crossing before July 16th of this year will be exempt from the new ban. It's estimated some 20,000 people are still waiting in Mexico for U.S. asylum hearings. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The leading U.S. medical group is calling for a total ban on all e-cigarette and vaping products. The AP's Mike Gracia has more on the story.
The American Medical Association is calling for an immediate ban on all electronic cigarettes and vaping devices. The AMA adopted its position at a policymaking meeting in San Diego. The AMA cited a surge in e-cigarette use by teens and the recent outbreak of lung illnesses linked to vaping. The AMA plans to lobby for laws, regulations, or legal action to achieve the ban.
The AP's Mike Gracia reporting there. And Amnesty International says Iranian security forces have killed at least 106 people in nationwide anti-government protests since Friday, but the Iranian government has not released any official numbers on deaths and injuries or arrests of the protesters. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Money Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 20th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The outgoing African Union ambassador to the United States says she did her job well.
African Union is now known worldwide because of what's being done out of the AU mission right here in Washington. And nobody can deny that. Why? Because I came to Washington to work. I didn't come to Washington to drink tea and coffee.
Kenya's Interior Ministry tops the list of most corrupt government entities. We'll look at some of the red flags ahead of next year's Guinean presidential election. Climate change puts North Africa in a hot spot. And two African airlines threatening to terminate services to South Sudan's Juba International Airport because of rampant theft of baggage.
There is a need for officials to have a specific kind of uniforms and the IDs always on display so that you will be able to know who is an official that you can trust and who is not.
And Nigerian authorities launched a campaign against open defecation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The outgoing African Union permanent representative to the United States says all programs and projects undertaken during her three-year tenure were within the mandate of her office. Ambassador Arikana Kiboriquao says some of the programs her office undertook included promoting Africa in the Americas and mobilizing the African diaspora. But in a press release, the African Union Commission said the programs initiated and implemented with African Union funds had no formal approval from the AU Commission. The AU also said it found no evidence that donations and funds collected in the name of the African Union mission were deposited in any AU accounts. Ambassador Kiboriquao says she more than delivered on her mandate and blames African Union Commission Chairperson Musa Faki of smearing her record.
Let me start by saying this. We are required to file quarterly progress reports. And during my quarterly progress reports, every time I implemented a program, I indicated which program I had implemented, what activity had taken place during that quarter, and that quarterly progress report would be forwarded to the chairperson secretary as well as the chief of staff. So all those programs, starting with PADWA, which is Pan-African Diaspora Women, Pan-African Diaspora Youth, Pan-African Diaspora Men, these were not registered entities. They were just entities created in order to bring diaspora together so the youth could come to the African Union and meet and discuss. And it also gave me an opportunity to also share with them what is going on in our Africa and the African Union.
So let me ask you, because that's what the African Union release said. It said that you carried out these programs without the knowledge or consent of the African Union itself. And above all, the African Union said that there were donations and funds were collected in the name of the African Union mission with no evidence that any of these amounts collected were deposited in African Union accounts.
Let me say this unequivocally. Not a single penny was ever donated to the African Union under my leadership. Anybody that says they donated a penny to the AU, they are false. There has never been a penny donated to the AU by anyone that was not deposited in the bank. Furthermore, we cannot even accept money. If we receive any donation, that donation has got to go to the AU. So I repeat, there has never been any donation made out to the AU that there is no accountability.
Ambassadors, did you tell the African Union that some of these projects or activities were your private engagements with no relationship to the African Union?
Absolutely not. If that was the case, why would I report these activities on my quarterly reports to the headquarters? Not only that, if you look at Invest in Africa magazine, I also spoke about this program. This magazine was put in front of each and every head of state during the summit, including Musa Faki himself, for 2 years. How do I deliver my mandate if I don't have programs?
Ambassador, did you make claims on social media or anyone connected with you to suggest that the decision to end your tenure was made because of pronouncements or opinions that you may have during your tenure?
Well, what I have said is I have communication that came from the chairman's office instructing my videos to be taken down off of the AU website. And subsequent conversations follow as to why that particular move was taken. That I have said it.
Ambassador, would you say that you successfully carry out your tenure?
Oh, my goodness. I more than successfully carried out my tenure. When I came to this mission, most people have never heard of the African Union. Even some people at the State Department told me they thought the mission was closed. Almost 100% of the congressmen that I encountered did not know there was even a mission. The office was dead. There was nothing going on. The director of HR at that time told me they were now using this office as a protocol office to book hotels and transportation for people coming from Addis. It's a shame. So, yes, I have more than delivered on my mandate. And the smear campaign coming from Musa Faki Mahamat is a downright shame. What I was doing out of this AU mission is what he, Musa Faki, should have been doing. But of course, he's not capable of doing it. If he was capable of doing it, we would be seeing a very different African Union. So instead of allowing me to do my work, fulfill all my mandate, he's too busy getting jealous of me. He's too busy wanting to shut me up. That's not going to work. I have delivered on my mandate above and beyond, and most people will tell you that they have been in Washington. One gentleman told me he's been in Washington for 50 years and he has seen many ambassadors come and go. He has never seen one ambassador who has done as much as I've done in such a short period of time. African Union is now known worldwide because of the work being done out of the AU mission right here in Washington, and nobody can deny that. Why? Because I came to Washington to work. I didn't come to Washington to drink tea and coffee. Anybody who tries to suggest that I took even a penny from the AU, it is laughable and shameful.
Ambassador Chiombori Kwao, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Arikana Chiombori Kwao is the outgoing African Union Permanent Representative to the United States. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Kenya's Interior Ministry tops the list of most corrupt government entities, according to a survey by the country's Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission. As Maureen Ojiambo reports, the Health Ministry and the Department of Registrar of Persons follow respectively.
The recent report by the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission of Kenya reveals that demand for bribe at the county government is too high, as Tana River County tops the list. Speaking during the release of the report, Director Preventive Service at the Commission, Vincent Okongo, says that most Kenyans preferred offering bribes to get government services, especially to the police, Registry of Persons, government hospitals, and the National Youth Service.
And when we asked the respondents the reasons they give for paying bribes, you can see that in the red part of that pie chart, it was only the way to get the service. So Kenyans are saying that for them to get services that they demand or they deserve, they have to pay a bribe. 50% said that. And that was followed by 28.6%, which said that it is the only way to hasten the process of getting that service.
The Commission, however, wants other amendments implemented, such as provision in law mandating state officers to step aside when under investigations or charged for corruption. Mr. Okongo says the public officers are demanding for bribe than those in private sector.
Registrar of Persons is leading with 19.9%, followed by public hospitals. Of course, the police is following closely. The offices of the chief and village elders, because these are the basic units of service delivery. In terms of the number of average bribes demanded by counties, and this shows the behavior of the public officer, because they're the ones demanding bribes, you can see that Tana River is now leading. Public officers in Tana River County are demanding more bribes, followed by Kilifi.
On the other hand, the Commission's chairperson, Eliud Obokala, said that the data will help strengthen anti-corruption strategy. Obokala wants timelines set for corruption cases to ease the backlog.
And some of the recommendations that we have provided as the way forward, as a multi-agency approach, is one to strengthen the need of expediting the hearing and the disposal of corruption cases by setting timelines, so that a case does not go on until all the witnesses die and then it becomes not interesting at all. We are also asking that a law be made for officers to step aside, state officers to step aside when under investigations or charged for corruption.
The respondents were drawn from 5,942 households in all the 47 counties. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Today's Wednesday, November 20th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. We send shout out to all our VOA affiliate stations around Africa. Daybreak Africa time, 15.5 minutes past the hour. Some international airlines flying to South Sudan's Juba International Airport say they will stop flying there because of repeated theft of baggage cases. A South Sudan civil aviation official says he is not aware of the decision by the Ethiopian and Kenyan airlines to stop flying to South Sudan, but he says he will hold meetings with the airlines to discuss their concerns. Winnie Sirino reports from Juba.
Government spokesperson Michael Makwe told reporters after the Council of Ministers met last Friday, Ethiopian Airlines and Kenyan Airways want to stop routes to South Sudan because of rampant theft of customers' luggage at Juba International Airport. 31-year-old Kwach Pech says he lost a carton of books when he flew on Ethiopian Airlines from Entebbe to Juba last year. Pech says people frequently lose their belongings at Juba International Airport because of what he calls disorganization at the arrival terminal, where he says airport staff are hard to identify.
Sometimes you don't even know whether these are part of the airport authority or they are just some hawkers around or people who are just like sometimes they will come and try to take your luggage tag from you forcefully, and you really have to stand your ground, tell them, no, wait guys, I'm doing it myself, or maybe somebody else is doing it for you.
Pet says he reported the case to Ethiopian Airlines staff in Juba and they tried to follow it up but did not recover the luggage. He says he suspects some officials hide luggage, and when the airlines follow up, then they present it. He says Juba Airport management should improve security and ensure that no luggage is lost. He says airport authorities should also stop non-airport staff from accessing the terminals.
There is a need for officials to have a specific kind of uniforms and the IDs always on display so that you will be able to know who is an official that you can trust and who is not. So with that, when something gets lost, it will easily be traced because the airport authority will know who are on duties that day.
Korkwal, managing director of Juba International Airport, says he had such allegations from a staff member and has taken action.
I give order to one of my secretary so that to write a circular to all international flights so that I had their complaints. Whether the issue will come up or not come up. Number two, also, we are approaching to the end of the year. And always at the end of the year, there are a lot of problems that can occur and all that. So that we prepare our order before that time came.
Pet says threats by Ethiopian and Kenyan Airlines to stop routing to South Sudan will affect several people because prices will shoot up. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
There are major red flags ahead of next year's Guinean presidential elections, according to a new report by Amnesty International. Francois Patoual, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International, tells Ricky Shryak that though there has been some progress, Guinean authorities continue to violently repress protesters.
People who express dissent, including journalists, but also human rights defenders and pro-democracy activists, continue to be arrested or subjected to judicial arrestment. And all this is happening in a context of complete impunity. The Guinean authorities are reluctant to acknowledge their responsibility in the current situation. They accuse the opposition of killing demonstrators, of dressing up as members of the security forces. And this climate of impunity is a very bad sign for the elections that are coming up. The presidential elections, which are scheduled in 2020, are contested. There are many questions, including whether President Conde will run for a third term, if the constitution will be changed. And it's very important that these elections happen in a context where people can express their views freely, including through peaceful protests without fearing reprisals.
What role does impunity play in the violence against protesters?
All of this is happening in a context of complete impunity. The ministers and the members of the security forces that we've met over the last 2 weeks are very reluctant to acknowledge the responsibility of the authorities and the security forces in the current situation. The president of the republic has blamed the opposition for some of the death in the protest. He said that some of the opposition members were dressing up as members of the security forces and then shooting protesters. High officials in the police force accused the protesters of throwing tear gas, for instance, in mosques and in a cemetery during a funeral march. The problem is that there's just no evidence and there's no investigation. When the death happen or when people are injured in demonstration, there's just no investigation and no judicial proceedings brought against suspected perpetrators.
How are journalists being targeted?
People who express dissent, including journalists, but also human rights defenders or pro-democracy activists, are also targeted in Guinea. First, because they are laws that have been passed since 2015, which enable the authorities to crack down on dissent. For instance, the Penal Code, which was adopted in 2016, or the Law on Cybersecurity, which was adopted also in 2016, criminalized things as insulting the head of state, or publishing false news, or publishing information which may undermine public order. And these laws are actually used then to arrest or prosecute journalists and human rights defenders.
Francois Patouel is an Amnesty International researcher for French-speaking West Africa. We are speaking to Ricky Shryak from Guinea's capital, Conakry. In October, a survey by the UN Children's Fund named Nigeria as the country with the highest number of people practicing open defecation. Authorities in Nigeria say they want to rid the country of this practice by 2025. Timothy Obiezu reports from Juba. From Abuja.
Baba Awolu reports to work at 5 a.m. each day at a local toilet and washroom facility he owns in the Jahi district of Abuja. The facility, known in the native Hausa language as Kidanwanka, was built to serve poor people without access to bathrooms. Awolu says he has to arrive early so he can attend to users who are preparing for the day. What we're doing is helping people and the government. Instead of going to nearby bushes to defecate, they can use our facility and pay a token. According to the UNICEF study, Nigeria recently became the country with the most people practicing open defecation, passing India, which outlawed the practice. About 25% or more than 47 million Nigerians lack access to toilet facilities. The majority are in rural areas where many poor people can't afford to install toilets in their homes. The result is defecation in bushes and fields, leading to contaminated water supplies and the spread of disease. At an event in Abuja this week, Nigerian authorities said they are determined to end open defecation and achieve UN sanitation goals by 2025, 5 years ahead of schedule. Only 14 out of the 774 local government areas in Nigeria are open defecation free, authorities say. The practice is more prevalent in north-central states, including Abuja, the capital. Muhammad Mahmoud is Nigeria's environment minister.
This commitment is demonstrated by Mr. President's declaration of state of emergency on water, sanitation, and hygiene in the country. With just 11 years to go to the 2030 deadline, we must redouble our effort to provide universal access to toilet, leaving no one behind.
Some 87,000 young children in Nigeria die each year from illnesses linked to open defecation, poor sanitation and hygiene. That number may fall, however, as more places like Baba Awolu's open across Nigeria, giving people regular access to working bathrooms and a boost to public sanitation. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Government leaders and experts plan a climate change summit in Madrid next month amid grim reports about the warming world. Sandwiched between an expanding Sahara and a rising Mediterranean Sea, North African countries are particularly vulnerable. From the Tunisian village of Beer Salah, Lisa Bryant takes a look at the challenges and what's being done.
Samira's Khaya doesn't have to look far to know times are changing. She sees it right here on the family farm.
There hasn't been rain in recent years. A lot of my fruit trees died.
Three quarters of Tunisia is threatened by desertification, land severely depleted by urbanization, population growth, intensive agriculture, and climate change. It's a problem across North Africa, which is getting too little rain and sometimes too much. Its coastal areas are threatened by rising sea levels. The entire Mediterranean region is considered a climate change hotspot, more vulnerable to its effects than other places. To the south, encroaching desert. South of the Sahara, a group of Sahel countries have launched an ambitious Great Green Wall initiative to plant hardy trees and grasses to fight desertification.
Donc le but c'est de replanter des arbres.
The goal is to replant trees, to return the Sahel to what it was about 60 years ago, when there was more forest cover.
Boetsch believes a similar regional initiative could also take root north of the Sahara.
Of course it can work, but the first problem is water. The second is getting communities to accept the projects.
So far, North African countries are fighting desertification individually, restoring oases, and planting tough native plant varieties. But experts say much more needs to be done. Here in eastern Tunisia, Sred and fellow farmers are growing drought-resistant acacia and moringa trees valued for their health properties. But some of the trees have died, and earning a profit isn't easy.
Everybody likes new products, but it's hard to market them.
These farmers aren't giving up. They know climate change is here, and they have to act. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Bir Salah, Tunisia.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A Congolese court sentenced the warlord to life in prison on Tuesday for numerous crimes against humanity, including the mass rape of more than 100 women in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Frederick Masudi Alimasi, also known as Koko Di Koko, was found guilty of rape, poison, torture, murder, and sexual slavery during a raid on a village in 2018, the court in Bukavu said. Two other militia members were also convicted, while two were found not guilty. The court also found that the Congolese government failed to protect the victims and ordered it to pay compensation. The outgoing African Union permanent representative to the United States says all programs and projects undertaken during her three-year tenure were within the mandate of her office. Ambassador Arikana Kiobori-Kwao says some of the programs her office undertook included promoting Africa in the Americas and mobilizing the African diaspora. But in a press release, the African Union Commission said the programs initiated and implemented with African Union funds had no formal approval from the AU Commission. The AU also said it found no evidence that donations and funds collected in the name of the African Union mission were deposited in any AU accounts. Ambassador Kiombori Kwao said she more than delivered on her mandate and blames African Union Commission Chairperson Musa Faki of smearing her record. That is it for this Wednesday, November 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you around the world a very, very good day.
I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars.
I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without.
The CD features Billie Eilish's Bad Guy.
So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type.
Lil Nas X, Old Town Road.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride.
And many of the greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.
What you got, man?